Beruchim Abayim Rabotai, welcome to another edition of our Wednesday night class. This week being Parashat Noah. It's a phenomenal story, no question about it. Quite dramatic. It's one of the most enjoyable stories maybe in the whole Torah. The kids love it. You read a story of God warning the world that a flood's going to take over. Flood's going to come and destroy everything. And Noah goes and he's warned and God tells him to build a Temah. The Temah is the size of a football field. And we read how all the animals came on the Temah. Noah supplied them food. He lives on the Temah for a year. It's a great story. But you have to wonder, why write it? There has to be a reason to write such a story. We always say it and it's true. That's what I've got a story for. Think about it. From Adam to Noah, there's 10 generations. Could be 500, 600, 700 years. What happened between Adam and Noah? Nothing. Man was born, he died, born, died, born, died. Noah, now we stop, pause. Next week's parasha, we talk about Avraham Avinu. There's 10 generations between Noah and Avraham. What happened in between all those generations? Not interested. See, the Torah is not going to tell you everything that ever happened, and I'm sure there's a lot of interesting things that happened in between. But if there's an optimum to modern or for eternity, we're not writing it. So these stories were handpicked out of a myriad of stories, and God sought to write it, especially after, remember, the story of Noah. Noah is not one of the Avot, so he doesn't have special status. You know, the Avot, you say, okay, we're going to give them preferential treatment. We're going to tell all their stories because, after all, we have a lot to learn from. Noah is, he's not even Jewish. He's not considered Jewish, Noah. Adam, you say, okay, you got to write the story. First man, set the scene. So we have to understand, it's the Torah wrote the story of Noah. There's obvious ramifications for our generation and lessons that must be learned, not can be learned. Very careful. Must be learned. And if in any generation there were lessons to be learned of the story of Noah, it is certainly ours. And we begin. There are two types of tzaddikim in the world. There's a type of tzaddik that we call tzaddik gamur. And then you have another type that's called tzaddik she'eno gamur. One is a perfect tzaddik, and one is a non-perfect tzaddik, and not a complete tzaddik. What's the difference between the two? Tzaddik gamur is a man that shelters himself, has no connection to society. He's almost a hermit. He understands that society is corrupt to a certain extent. He understands that man is very flexible and bends to his surroundings. And then if he doesn't want to get involved with people, he locks himself in the room like the Gaon de Vilna used to do. The Gaon de Vilna at the end of his life had nothing to do with people. He had Bet Midrash. He used to have even shutters on the window. He used to close the shutters and learn by the light of the candle all day long. When they came to him and said, Hakam, there's no chokhmah, there's no trick to sit in your room all day long. Why don't you come out? I'm not looking to do any tricks, by the way. I'm not a magician. So that doesn't tell us you have to do any tricks. I'm sitting over here not to get affected by society. That's what we call tzaddik gamur. Most people cannot live that strict life of the Gaon de Vilna not to be exposed to live in such an insulated life. Most people, especially those that attend this class, are part of the category of tzaddik she'eno gamur. Wonderful. It's a great compliment. What does it mean, tzaddik she'eno gamur? It means we go out in the real world, we talk with people, we communicate, we have dealings with the outside influences of olam hazeh, but we try to our best capability not to get affected, not to sink. And we hope that at the end of everything, when God would compare us to what the world is and what we are, we're better. So long as we're better, we can consider ourselves tzaddik she'eno gamur. We're not perfect. We're tainted. we've been influenced to a certain extent, but at least if you compare to what the world is involved in and what you're involved in, well, big difference. So we call that a relative tzaddik. Relative to the generation, you're much better than everybody else. A lot of rabbis would say Noah was that type of tzaddik. After all, he lived with these people. These people were corrupt. You cannot imagine a corrupt society. See, the problem with discussing the corruption of the society of Noah is nobody's going to be shocked. 100 years ago, if we talk about these lowlives, everybody would say, what? How'd they do that? How can they? Today, anything I'm going to tell you, you'll be pale-faced. You'll take it with a grain of salt, because any perversion that they had, we have today. As a matter of fact, we have it new and improved. We've even modernized and expanded the perversions of the Torah. So therefore, it's almost a wasted exercise to try to shock you. Oh, the ladies in the times of Noah walked around without clothes. You say, okay, what else? Big deal. We know that already. That tell that to a society 100 years ago. The society of Noah walked around. What, really? What does that mean? What is that? We can't visualize. A lady can walk, not dressed. That was a society of immodesty. That was the code. It was done on purpose. It was a society where adultery was permissible. That became the law of the land. You see, part of the breakdown of society in the generation of Noah was not only were they perverts, but they legalized it. You see, they didn't want to live at home in a conscience. They didn't want to make a avon and then say, oh, we broke the law, haram, we can't sleep, we might get caught. So every time they fell another notch, before they fell, they made a law, mutarim nachem, mutarim nachem, mutarim nachem, now go do as your heart's desire, live. So adultery became the law of the land. As a matter of fact, we read that it was a homosexual society, Rahman Asilam. Men with men, Shema Yisrael. This already was beginning of creation, the year 1000, 1200, 1300, 1400 to creation. Already they sunk to this level. But it was worse. It became legal. They wrote marriage documents. A man would go with a man. They'd make a shetar. So-and-so is married legally, and they gave him certain privileges. But it's even worse than that, unfortunately. The Gemara brings down that the men, in the times of Noah, did not limit their relations with men. And if you forgive me, the Sibur would forgive me for even being so explicit. But it says there was men with animals. Chas v'shalom. Bestiality, what they call it in our society today, which is a terrible thing. And that became legal. You get an invitation in the mail. Mr. So-and-so proudly invites you to the wedding of his son, who's marrying a baboon that's going to take place in the Bronx Zoo on Tuesday afternoon. You're all invited. Please don't feed the animals. Instead of saying, please dress modestly on the bottom of the invitation, please don't feed the animals. This was legalized. This is what they were doing in that society. As a matter of fact, it's brought down in Midrash that they saw that the society was progressively becoming weaker. The people themselves becoming weaker. Damesha was a giant that was strong. But as the generations passed, the world wasn't producing those giants that they had. So what did they do? They wanted to create the supreme race. Almost like Yamach Shemam, the Germans tried to do in our times, to create a superior race, the Aryan race. They tried to do that. So what they did was, they banned any lady from having children unless she was approved by government first. They had to look at her, see how tall she was, how beautiful she was, and then they had to approve the husband to see if he fit the strength and the build and the traits, and then they would mate them, again, like animals, and produce the perfect product that they wanted. And in the event, if somebody, a lady, did become pregnant, which, again, she was not allowed, they would commit abortion. So abortion was very prevalent in the times of Noah. killing little fetuses, which is alive. It's murder. Furthermore, if the child was born, they had no compunction in killing the child. So you talk about Noah. He lived with these people. He lived for 600 years before he actually got on the Teba and sailed away. He saw them. He dealt with them. He talked with them. To say Noah was Sadiq Amur, very hard. He wasn't sheltered. He was there. They were talking with him, and he was with them. So relative to the generation, yes, Noah, you're a champ. He didn't subscribe to any of these behavior patterns. But at the same time, we're told that if Noah was living in the times of Abraham, compare him to Abraham, and Noah really doesn't measure to too much. So again, Sadiq She'enu Gamur, a Sadiq that is magnified because the people around, you know, if you have two pieces of jewelry, both inexpensive. So I show you the first piece of jewelry, the less piece, the worst piece, and you look at it, you say, ooh, this is, I would never buy such a thing. What are you even embarrassing my taste? This is costume. This is not nice. Okay, wait, I got something else to show. I take out another piece, which is also a cheap piece, but a little nicer than the first piece. So now you say, oh, yeah, why? It's much better. This is nice. Now, it's only nice because you saw, I have to teach you how to be a salesman, by the way. This is a technique of salesman. The salesman, when he wants to sell an item, what does he do? First, he shows the worst item. And he lets the customer shamble the item. So, what do you think it is? What are you trying to do? Garbage over here. Okay. Now you take out the other, which is also an inferior item. It's not a great product. But after you show them the garbage, anything's going to look good. So when you tell, hey, it looks better. Okay, now you're talking. If you would have just shown him that alone, he's able to right away see. Now, by the way, I'm not saying that's mutar to start fooling and things like that. I'm just thinking in my mind that would be a good idea, but I'm not saying it's halakhically correct. Shalom, we're not breeding cheaters over here. In any event, that's what happened to Noah. Put Noah alone, you say, okay. Good guy, no question about it, but nothing to, you know, make a big deal. Put him next to the society that he lived. That's what I write. Noah is Sadiq Tamim Ayah Bedorotav. In his generation, man's great. Comparative Sadiq. It's interesting to point out. At the end of Noah's life, when he's coming off the Teva, he's the only one left in the world. What does the Torah write about Noah? Vayisha'er ach Noah. He's just Noah alone. Meaning, when there's nobody around anymore, he's not no more Noah HaSadiq. Only when you're comparing him to people around him is he Noah HaSadiq. But after the flood is over, when he's the only guy left in the whole world, he retorts back to plain old Noah to show us what type of man he was. Again, Chas v'Shalom, that is bad. But we're just putting him in the proper perspective. We can relate to a man like Noah. Man lives in a terrible society and stays afloat as a little better than them. As a matter of fact, there's a pasuk that says, Sohar ta'aseh la'teva. Most commentaries learn Sohar. It was a window. They built a window on the ark. However, there is an opinion that says, no, it wasn't a window. It was actually shiny stones that at night they glisten, and that would be the light source. So they didn't get the light. They didn't have a window. They had these stones over here that would light up. Okay. Why the argument? What was so bad of having a window on the Teva? Why does a rabbi have to go out of his way and make a whole chidush? It was special shiny stones. What's the matter with it? Doesn't every ark, for that matter, every structure, whether it's a building or a boat, have windows? So it's not the worst thing in the world to say, Noah put a window. Not so illogical to say that was part of the plan. Why did he go out of the limb, this rabbi, and say, no, there's no windows. It was some stones. And the explanation is as follows. You see, when Avraham Avinu was going to destroy the city of Sedom with the Malach, he went to save his nephew Lot.
and Lot's wife.
And as they're flying out of the city, Abraham tells Lot, hey, listen, there's explosions going on behind you. They're destroying everyone's night. Don't turn around. You can't look. Lot says, why can't I look? He says, listen, because you're really supposed to be with them. You're supposed to be dying with them. You're only being saved in my zechut. Because you have an influential uncle, I'm taking out, so it's not proper for you to watch your friends die when you're as guilty as them. Maybe you should have been with them. But therefore, don't look. His wife that looked, okay, she turned into a whole salt factory, and she got her punishment, for whatever reason why that happened. Noah really was affected by the society. Noah wasn't as bad as them, but you can't say he's the perfect tzaddik. And because he's not the perfect tzaddik, he has no right to look out the window and see them dying. If he was tzaddik amur, you could watch. But since Noah himself is not so perfect, he has no right to look out the window to watch all his friends and all his society burning and drowning and dying. Therefore, the rabbi says, Hasrishon, there was no window on Noah's eye. It was listening stones. The lesson is powerful. You see, there's striking correlations between Noah's generation and ours. Our generation is also immodest. Our generation, someone once said, just at looking at magazine covers alone, we will see more immodesty than our great-grandmothers have seen in their entire lifetimes. We don't understand what modesty means, and we can't even relate to the concept of tzniut. Some would say provocative dress is even worse than no dress at all. So therefore, maybe in our times, it's even worse what's going on. This includes billboards on our bus stops, and billboards on the city buses, and billboards throughout the neighborhood, especially in Manhattan. But we become callous to it and immune to it. But there's definitely a society of immodesty. I haven't watched television, Baruch Hashem, for a long time. But I don't know if all the ladies on television cover their hair these days or are wearing long skirts beyond the knee with stockings and dresses below the elbow. Could be. I don't want to pass judgment if I don't know. But this is just a guess that I'd like to make. So it's a society of immodesty. A strong correlation between the generation of the Mabul. It's the land that the law of the land is pro-abortion. This has been passed down by the Beit Din, by the Supreme Court, and has not been overturned yet. Imagine that. Our ladies. Ladies are protected federally. The government can get escorted in order to go into a facility where they kill their children, just as they did in the times of Noah. Regarding homosexuality, in our society, gay people have rights. Isn't that amazing? It's not enough that we let you walk in the street. It's not enough that we let you breathe our air. But now you want rights? Animals! To just come and with chutzpah to march in our city and demand equality. And of course, the government gives it to them. Just like in the times of Noah, people can marry, they can adopt, they can live perfectly normal lifestyles. There was a movement not so many years back to even create a curriculum in the public schools called Rainbow Curriculum, Shema Yisrael. Rainbow curriculum. Rainbow. Why did they pick rainbow? Because when Noah got off the Teva, Borei Olam made a rainbow and said, this is a sign. Every time you see a rainbow, it means I was supposed to bring a flood to the world, but I didn't because I promised you. So they called their rainbow curriculum to remind us of the Avon of Gora Mabul. And what they do, they wanted to change all the books instead of saying Tom and Jane went to the store, they went, Tom and Harry went to the store, and they saw them, Kehilu, they married, in order to show the children alternate lifestyles. Nachman the Sivan, is that not legalizing this perversion? You tell me the difference between our generation and the generation of the Mabul. But even in the great colleges, and that's a paradox. There is no such thing as a great college. You forgive me. But on the college campuses throughout America, where all the liberal teachings, all the liberal philosophies, taught by all professors that subscribe to all sorts of pleasures and desires of this world. Yale University! Hashuv! Ivy League! I say poison Ivy League! Over here in Yale University a few years back, there was an Orthodox lady, you read about it in the news, Orthodox lady that told the dean, probably he's a Jewish man, and said, I cannot dorm in a co-ed dormitory. All your university has co-ed dormitory, boys and girls living together, sharing the same bathrooms together. 18, 19, 20, 21. So she came along. She said, I'm Orthodox. It's against my religion. And there was a court case, and the dean comes along without any embarrassment or compunction or shame. And he says, Yale is not only about classrooms and textbooks, but part of the education, a deep institutional value of our university is that the students dorm together and live in a collegiate community. Imagine that. Part of the education is to put hot-blooded boys and girls together. What do you think? The boys are teaching the girls social studies and reviewing science and preparing them for tests. What does this naive professor think is going on in the Ivy League co-ed dormitory of Yale University? He knows exactly what's going on. And he says that that's part of the college experience. This is not merely a dorm. This is education. It's a 24-hour experience. And this is going on in the highest levels of education. So you can imagine what type of society we have when the most intellectual, when the most bright subscribe to these types of filth and attitudes. We talk about shekher in our society, a society where there is no truth, and we become so numb that we can't even point it out when it's in front of our eyes. Recently, our city witnessed a subway series. Most of you probably have no idea what that even means. Shechem, you're Sadiqim. I'm not as righteous as you. Yeah, two local teams got together, and they got on the field, they played some baseball. That's a wonderful thing. And during one of the games, famous pitcher, Roger Clemens, okay, Shem the Shahid Cobb, he takes the baseball bat and hurls it on the first baseline. I know this is a Torah class, ladies, but we're getting to a point. Hurls it down the first baseline, direction of the catcher, Piazza, his name is, and there, helter skelter breaks out. Teams come out of the dugout in order to protest. Every sports commentator talked about this for many days after. It's on every page of the newspaper, front and back. Came the Advid Dean of Baseball, the commissioner, and he says, Has v'shanom, lo te'ekezot v'yisrael, we cannot tolerate such attitudes. And he levies a $50,000 fine, and he's condemned, and the players condemn him, and the managers condemn him. The whole world is talking about it. They replay it hundreds of times, and the World Series will be remembered as the series where a man took a baseball, and when asked, what was your kavanah He repeats a thousand times, no intent, no intent. I didn't mean it, no intent, no intent. Beautiful, man saying he has no intent. Chalasna, what do you want? And in the same newspaper, they show pictures of Arabs hurling rocks. And they ask the Arabs, what are you doing? Intent, intent, intent. Kavanah to kill. And where's the world? Where's the commissioner of baseball? Where's everybody? Oh, comes the UN. And the UN comes along and says, condemn Israel. How dare you let yourself get rocks thrown at you? Guilty. Who's guilty here? For throwing a baseball bat in the direction of a player, the whole world went crazy. Haram! It's no good. But when Arabs are firing rocks in order to decapitate soldiers, what does the world say? Oh, poor Arabs. Poor soldiers. Imagine that. Shikr! In front of our eyes. And that goes without saying, the shikr, the falsehood, the lies that are written in the textbooks of our education. In most textbooks, still in school, even in our yeshivas, unfortunately, there is talk of evolution theory. To say that the world was not created by God, Chas v'Shalom, but to say it was the happenings of many explosions that made this beautiful world. You know, the other day, on Ocean Parkway, most amazing thing happened. Two cars collided into each other. It was a terrible accident. And it was a very big explosion. But after the smoke went away, they noticed a beautiful big stretch limousine turned out of that accident. That's exactly what evolution is saying. Ellie, can we help you? I don't want that, but you're walking around. Somebody's blocking the driver, anybody? Guy's going crazy, nobody. They don't do that over here. Now, of course, they don't block driveways. They know better than that. In any event, we talked about this. In any event, that's how ludicrous it is. And that's what they're teaching the children of America. There was bombs, and after the bombs were over, there were roses that came out of it, and flowers, and a wonderful chicken. Chicken is all over the place. So we go back, and we try to compare the generation of Noah, and we look at our generation, mirror image. Exactly. The world has gone full circle. We've come back right where we began. You can imagine, just as angry as God was at that time, the anger that Borei Olam has. And Chas v'Shalom, I'm not the one to start waking up prosecution against Am Yisrael. But it's in our face, we see it clearly, as clear as day. But the Midrash tells us that in the times of Noah, it was not merely a breakdown of society, but even the animals became corrupt. And the rabbis tell us that the animals were going with each other. The ze'ev, the wolf, went with the lion, and the birds went with the... so on and so forth. It was a total break. Even the ground became non-loyal. The farmer planted wheat, and barley came out. Imagine that! How is it possible that even the animals became corrupt? Because when society breaks down, when man acts in a decrepit way, he brings down the whole world. Man's action can even affect the way the animals act. So it started with man, but it trickled down already to the animals. It's interesting, there was a study written in the New York Times 10 years ago, not that the New York, anything the New York Times is a lie. That should not give any credence to what I'm saying. You know, some people like to use the New York Times to say it was written in the Times. I'm saying I shouldn't have said it. If anything, that maybe the story to say is not true because it was written in the New York Times. I take that back. There was a study done. And the study was in San Francisco that they did a study on a certain pigeon that its population was falling. They didn't understand it. Why all the other pigeons, the population was growing, And this pigeon was not flourishing and populating. The study was done in the city of San Francisco. And they came to the conclusion, these are scientists, or whatever they call themselves, and they came out to the conclusion that the pigeons were gay. Gay pigeons! Imagine that. Shocking. Excuse me again. And therefore, they weren't mating. All the females died out, or they were whatever they were doing. And the male pigeons, were, I don't have to explain it to you. You're old enough to understand what happens over here. They're not babies. In any event, isn't that a coincidence? In San Francisco, the capital of the world of these Rishayim, you see already it trickled down to the Alaski. Hashid, Kol Basar, Ibdarko, Ala'aretz. Kol Basar, Kol Basar. All living creatures. So, we're in trouble. We're in trouble. The good part of the story is that God promised not to bring another flood. So besides that, we have an exact carbon copy, two generations, thousands of years apart, but all align themselves with the same thinking. And now comes the Jew, and he wonders how to save himself. Noah had a trick. We have to figure out what that trick was, but he saved himself. So you have some Jews that come along with a very arrogant attitude, and they say, you know what? I don't get affected. It doesn't bother me. I do my thing. They do their thing. You know, you can't be a hermit. You got to live in society, and just don't worry. If you're strong, you won't get affected. It will not bother you. Now, that's a very immature attitude. As a matter of fact, there was a study done by a doctor called Dr. Ash. Such an interesting study. Goy! He did the study in colleges throughout America. Later, that same study was done in the Beit Yaakov in Flatbush. What was the study? Came Dr. Ash. He took six students to his experiment. Five of them were planted. Five students are part of the sketch. The sixth one is actually the experiment, but they don't let him know that. They bring all six into the room. You have any idea what that was going on with you? Okay, sit down, I'll sit down. They're sketching the sixth guy. Dr. Ash goes on the blackboard. He draws two lines. The first line, 10 inches long. The second line, 12 inches long. It's obvious the second line is longer than the first line. And Dr. Ash asked the first five students, which line is longer? And they all say confidently, no question, the first line, first line, first line, first line, first line. All of them, come out, what kind of question? Now they go to the sixth guy. Okay, which line is longer? 60% of the time, the sixth guy would say the top line is longer. Imagine that! And then, the experiment doesn't end. In the event, in the other 40% that gave the right answer, that's not what I mean, that's not shoot. The bottom line is longer. Then what they did was the five would start to combat it. What are you talking? Are you crazy? You see? You're telling me the bottom of, I can't believe it. I can't. There was such a butter under there, brother. I can't believe what this guy's saying over the bottom. I can't. You believe a guy can? The 40% out of those, an additional 30% changed their mind. I said, oh, I was just joking. Yeah, you're right. Can you take a joke? Of course, it's not lying. What are you talking about? So he came to the conclusion, 90% of the people buckled to the peer pressure. Now, what kind of people are we talking about? The college students, some of them are professors, bright people that you'd say have good judgment. But because the pressure was so strong, they went with them. They could not stand up to what was right, and they acquiesced. So nobody should be so naive to think, I know that doesn't bother me. We're in the minority. The majority is corrupt, especially in our country, especially in our city. And therefore, to think that we're able to live without doing any action to combat it, And we'll be able, us all will be drawn to the majority before we bring the majority to us, as proven in that experiment. They did another experiment. You wonder where I get all this information. I wonder myself where I'm finding all these things. It's actually amazing if you think about it. It's not, nothing that we're doing in the Kollel. It's not a... Probably get thrown out of the Kollel with all these experiments that I'm talking about. In any event, there was another experiment that was brought down that they took people into a movie theater. They brought them in there for the experiment. And they said, we're showing you a movie. The movie is fake, meaning it never happened. You're going to see people dying. You're going to see people getting sick. You're going to see all sorts of things. No, it's Hollywood. It's staged. Nobody died. It's not real. It's a joke. Okay, they go watch the movie. In the middle of the movie, they see the lady's crying. They tell her, we told you it's not real. We told you it's fake. We told you it's not. It's a, what are you crying for? I don't know. The guy died. The guy didn't die. So they came to the conclusion that you could know it's wrong. You could be told it's wrong, but still, it affects you. Still, you have emotions. Laughing, crying, upset. And she walks out of the movie, I'm in a terrible mood. Why are you in a terrible mood? Nothing happened. The guy, he's here, he's alive still. What are you worried about? No. So they took it a step further. They went and they brought the actors that were in that movie, who acted. And they said, come to the theater, we want you to watch it. And they hooked them up to all sorts of apparatus to measure their pulse, to measure their heartbeat, and their blood rate. And they noticed that as the drama got more intense, and in one of the scenes, the knife was taken out, and they stabbed one of these actors, you see the guy's pulse go wild, and his heartbeat starts beating, and his blood rate goes... And they tell the guy, what are you getting all excited about? You're alive. You're watching yourself die, but you can't watch it. You watch yourself, you're dead. Which means you know the sketch. You're in the movie. Who knows more than you? He's like, no, I can't help it. I know what you... Just watching it affected them. So you see clearly again. Man, lady, are very impressionable. Therefore, society definitely can affect attitudes, philosophies, and thinking patterns of people. And don't kid yourself. As a matter of fact, even angels, malachim, to a certain extent, can get affected by a corrupt society. Say, Rabbi, please. This is mugzam. This is exaggerating now. An angel can get affected. I'll bring a proof to this. I have to prove it. I'll prove it. The angels come to visit Abraham. You're familiar with the story. He serves them food. And the pasuk says they sat down and ate. Vayochil. Now she's bothered. Angels don't eat. So what does that she say? It looked like they were eating. They sketched. They took the food next to their mouth. And the food burnt. So those that were looking, it looked like that, because angels don't eat. Okay, it's nice. Later on, those same angels, or different angels, they come to Lot. They visit him in Sodom. Lot, a loyal student of Abraham, serves them food. Pasuk says by the angel, by Yochelu. Over there, Rashi doesn't comment and say, well, it looked like they ate, because the angel, that over there it says they ate, and they ate. What happened? The rabbis say, because when they went out to Sodom, what happened to the angel? He fell. So even the angel that's on a high mountain, the guy that doesn't eat, when he got to Sodom, already had an appetite. When he got to Sodom, he said, I'm hungry. What's for dinner? What are we going to eat tonight? Even the malach can get affected by a perverted society. And if that's doesn't prove it to you yet. If that doesn't solidify the theory that I'm telling you, that we are being affected by the world around us. It's a statistic that I recently heard. It's actually a statistic that we have to tear our shirts when we hear, Hasra Shalom, that in the religious community. Spanish, they call them the from community. The ultra-Orthodox religious people. We have lost in Borough Park, Flatbush, our neighborhoods, about 2,000 young men and ladies. These are boys that went to yeshiva. These are girls that went to Beit Yaakov. And these are boys and girls that roam the streets of Ocean Parkway on Friday night smoking cigarettes and doing all sorts of abominations. So you tell me that the influence of this corrupt world is not affecting our youth and our children. And they're not getting it at home, that's for sure. The home their father's a rabbi sitting in Kollel. Their mothers are teachers. Their mothers are educators. The cream of the crop people. And we're seeing the children go off the path at an astronomical rate. So you tell me statistics already are proving it black and white. That the society is affecting even the most religious people. But allow me to continue. Yaakov Avinu, at the age of 63, was told by his father that it's time for him to go and get married. And he should go to the house of Lavan, and over there he'll find a wife. Yaakov Avinu says, fine, 63 is old enough. It's time. Yaakov sets out to Lavan's house, and we know that on the way there, he stops off at the yeshiva of Shem Zayvet. He actually stops off there for 14 years. Question is asked by Rabbi Yaakov Kamenevsky, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. What do you think he was doing in Yitzhak Avinu's house for 63 years? Playing tole? Playing backgammon? Yaakov most certainly was learning Torah with Yitzhak for 63 years. Yitzhak had a yeshiva. So after you graduate with honors from the yeshiva of Yitzhak for 63 years, what more are you going to learn from another yeshiva called the yeshiva of Shem Da'evet? Well, what do you need it for? Just go to Lavan's house. Yaakov Kamenevsky says a most wonderful idea. It's worth it just to hear this idea. If you got nothing from this class tonight, just this chidush, it's a big profit. Yaakov Kamenevsky says, the yeshiva of Yitzhak and the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eved, different curriculum. Yitzhak Avinu was born, he lived in the house of Abraham, Sadiq Gamur, perfect surroundings, never had exposure, never left Eretz Yisrael, stayed in a perfect surrounding. His Torah was the Torah of insulation, the Torah of the Gaon, the Vilna life, not leaving the Bet Midrash, staying. That Torah is very good. That Torah is pure, it's perfect. But now Yaakov Avinu's going to the real world. He's leaving the Bet Midrash of Yitzhak. He's going now to Lavan. He's going to Manhattan. He's going to 42nd Street, 34th Street. He's going to be with a lot of characters, cheaters and tricksters and all sorts of people. Sure, he had a good education, but now he has to go to the masters who can teach him how to live with Lavan. So he goes to the yeshiva of Shem Ve'eved. Shem is the son of Noach. Who knows better? Man lived through Dor HaMabul. He saw the worst people. He saw the worst corruption. And he made it. He graduated the Mabul and opened up a yeshiva, one of the most prestigious institutions of its time. Shem had a lot to teach Yaakov about remaining a great man even outside in the real world. Eved, the grandson of Noach, he lived in the generation of Panaga, which you read at the end of this parasha. He lived in the generation where they built the tower to fight God. He lived in a generation that people were rebellious. The king's name was Nimrod himself. Man was a rebellious man. And what? He graduated that generation and became a partner in building Yeshiva Shem V'Hezen. Yaakov Avinu said, I need to hear Stat Torah, the Torah of Shem V'Hezen now. I need that curriculum to teach me how I can remain Yaakov outside the walls of the yeshiva, outside the walls of Yitzhak, outside the ghetto, outside that insulated community. I mean, even Yaakov Avinu was scared. So then, what's the answer? So we have to go back to the parasha, and we have to see what Noah did. The answer is actually found in the Gemara Zevachim. It's a very interesting Gemara. The Gemara says all the animals were on the Teva. What about the Re'im? What was the Re'im? Gemara says the Re'im was a gigantic animal. You know, like the whale is in the ocean, the biggest of the fish, the Re'im is a, forget it, a monstrosity of an animal. So the Gemara asks, how did the Re'im fit on the Teva? He's got to save it. Where are you going to put this guy? He's bigger than the Teva. As a matter of fact, the Midrash tells a story. David HaMelech was once walking in the shepherd, and he saw a mountain, and he said, okay, you got to climb the mountain. So as he gets on the mountain, it turned out it was the Re'im, and the Re'im was leaning over. Now he's on the back of the Re'im, and the Re'im gets up, they walk away, and David found himself thrusted in between the earth and the Shamayim, and David HaMelech was bahar. He says, what's going to be now? I thought he was going to die. And then he prays to Borei Olam, and the Re'im bent down again, and he climbed off. David HaMelech says, I thank you, God, Mekarneh Re'imim Anitani. You answered me from the horns of the Re'imim. You see, it's a tremendous thing. It's a Mount Everest. Okay, so the Gemara has a question. How did they get to the Re'im on the boat? So the Gemara, in its first attempt, says, Noah put baby Re'ims under this Mizbeach. He didn't wait till they got the Ja'ash, but the small ones. So the Gemara comes back and says, even the smallest Re'im is still gigantic. So can't fit him on the Teva. So the Gemara comes out and says, what Noah did was, this is, I admit, I concede, a bit strange, but it says that the Re'im stuck its nose into the Teva. So while, you're right, you can't fit the whole guy on the Teva, the rest of the body's outside floating, whatever it's doing out there. And it's a, okay, so it's a little awkward. I know you've seen books or pictures of the Teva. You don't see some guy's nose thrusted into one of the walls of the Teva, but it seems that's what Gemara's saying. Okay? Now, it's a great trivia, this Gemara. I'm not saying that this is a Hiddush you should say over a Friday night table. It's not the most appetizing Hiddush. The guy's nose is in the Teva. But the point is, what do we have to notice for? It's a nice fact. I'm not saying this is good. You can test the kids in the youth minyan. You hit them this question, you give them 1,000 tickets. You get a water gun if they get the answer. But what do you got to know? Put it this way. If I didn't answer the question for you tonight, if I just said the Gemara asked, how did they fit to the air on the Teva? And I didn't answer you. You said, okay, no big deal. No one's calling me to lie. By the way, you asked the question. You didn't answer me. I can believe it's like that. No big deal. Man. Don't put it on. Put it on. Who cares how they put it on? But the Gemara has to make such a big deal about the Re'im. Could it be maybe that the Hachamim had, besides the simple Peshach, which I'm not denying, a deeper intention? I think so. And I once heard from my Rosh Yeshiva, Chaim Kreisler, the chief rabbi of Antwerp, Gaon Adir, one of the Gedolim, men knows Shas, Ba'alpeh, Babi, and Yerushalmi. Very, very big Gaon. I once heard him put a shot in this Gemara. He says like this. He said, Noah Teva What was it? He says, well, outside of Teva, you had a world of atheism, a world of corruption and perversion and pleasure, and the lowest level of people. That's outside. Outside that, an anti-Torah atmosphere. The Teva actually was a yeshiva. Noah, his family. On the Teva, there's no bed. On the Teva, Noah is protected from all outside influences. The air is good, the quality is good, the philosophy is good, the thinking is good. God is with Noah on the Teva. That's the yeshiva. The Gemara is asking, Noah had a zechut to live on the Teva. He's in the yeshiva all day long. He saved himself, sure. Those that can sit in the Kolel all day long, surely the Kolel is a pure place, it's a clean place, there's no outside influence in town. What question is being asked right now? If you'd say, where does a person have a chance to go off the path more? 34th Street and 5th Avenue or the Kolel? Probably has a bigger chance of losing his course in life on 34th Street. A lot of things going on over there. A lot of distractions. Over there, what do you have? Books, rabbis, Torah. Perfect. Tahor. That's the Teva. So the Gemara is saying, but how did the Am get on the Teva? How did the Am exist? The Am referring to this big structure, this big animal. He says it means, what about the masses? What about everybody else? Noah is the minority. What about the rest of Am Yisrael? All the other people that cannot live on the Teva? What about the masses, the millions of Jews that cannot be in the yeshiva all day long? How are they going to exist? The Gemara answers, Noah put small ve'emim in the Teva, meaning that with an education at a young age, by sending our children when they're young into the Teva full time to stay there, so by the time they graduate and leave the Teva, they'll have a solid background. Comes the Gemara and says, nah, even that's not enough. To rely on a yeshiva education because you lived on the Teva when you were young, nah, that won't help you when you get older. Still you need help. So the Gemara answers, you know what? You're right. The Am existed only because it stuck its nose into the Teva. It's still, majority of its body was not in the Teva. The majority of the body was on 34th Street. But its nose, part of itself, was connected to the yeshiva. And that's how it existed. And that's the answer to the question. The answer, how does a Jew in this turbulent world, outside these doors, ladies and gentlemen, there's a flood. There's a flood of kefira, a flood of shekel, a flood of terrible desires and perversions. How does a man or lady exist and not be affected? You must be connected to the Teva. This room over here is a modern Noah's Ark. This is a Teva. This room over here, there's no negative attitude. We learned the word of God. It's pure philosophy. There's no evil over here. True, you can't stay here all day. We wish we could. You have to go out and earn a living. But you have to be like to the end. You have to breathe the air of the yeshiva, of the kolel, periodically to stay alive. That's our life support. Through attending the yeshiva, through attending class, through frequenting yourself in the synagogue. That's the modern day, that's an asylum. That's a safe haven. Those that frequent themselves in the Teva, not only are they gaining wisdom, but more so they're saving themselves from the society. In the olden days, the father would send his kid to yeshiva for wisdom. And the kids can come home and dorm home at night. Today, the Steitler Rebbe said, we send our kids to yeshiva not only to give them wisdom, but to keep them off the streets, to insulate them, to keep them away from everybody else. And that's the same thing today. The modern day Teva is our yeshivot. There's a interesting Mishnah, if I may. I know we're going a little overtime. You forgive me. The Mishnah at the end of Avot says, Amar Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma, Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma said, Ha'amachad, Hayiti me'alech baderech. This one time I was walking on the road. Ufagah bi adam echad, a fellow met me on the road. Menatani shalom, tomi shalom. Ra'odati lo shalom, I replied back. Amar li, Nabi, Rabbi, me'etze v'akom ata, min jayye, where do you come from? Amarti lo, mi'ir gedona shel hachamim v'shel sofrim. I come from a big city of rabbis, of scholars. Amar li, the fellow tells me, Rabbi, Rabbi, resulcha shishnadur amana v'mkomenu, why don't you come live with us? Ve'ani yeten lecha elef alafim din rezahav, I'll give you $1 million salary, Abanim Tobot, Mergeliot, I'll spoil your wife with jewelry, with everything. Amarti lo, the rabbi didn't have to think that much. He said, Beni, my son, Im atan oten yikol kesef bezahav ba'abanim tobot u'mergeliot sheba'olam. If you give me all the flus in the world, Eni da ela b'makom Torah, I will only live in a place of Torah. That's the Mishnah. Rabbi was very focused. So the Mephashim is spring. What happened here? Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma lived in the yeshiva. One day he left. One day he walked out. Pa'am ahat! One time! Hayiti me'alech baderech. He went in the street. All it takes is one time already. Yetzer hara came to him and said, Chacham, where do you come from? And he said, I come from the city of rabbis. And then what does the fellow say? Come, why don't you be our rabbi? How did he know to answer no? Why not? Why not go be the rabbi? It's a nice salary. They want a hakam, obviously. Why did he reject it so quickly? And the Mephashim explained, that's how you hire a rabbi. The first guy you see on the street, you don't know he's all you ask. See him and say, where do you come from? Oh, I live in Lakewood. Oh, Lakewood? Yeah, you want to come to our city? We'll make the Roscoe. Well, you know about me. Maybe I'm not a rabbi either. That's how you interview a hakam. Hey, so already this guy over, and then he's coming to say, I'll pay you all sorts of money. You'll pay me, man. After the Yahweh, you're going to pay me all the sorts. So already he saw that this fellow over here did not understand what the value of threat. And obviously the city that he was going to, he says, for surely to have no Torah there. How did he know there was no Torah? Because we have a rule. Anything that's expensive means there's a shortage of it. Jewelry is gold is expensive. Why? Not that much gold. The more common or the more available an item is, the cheaper it. Water, balash. Almost balash. Bread, cheaper also. Diamond, very expensive. So they're coming along and saying, wow, a rabbi? Sure, we'll pay $1 million for a rabbi. $1 million for a rabbi. It must be the dinosaur. Must be such a rare item. I'm not going to a place where $1 million for hakam. This already indicates that you have no Torah. In any event, the rule of Rabbi Yosef ben Kisma was, I only want to live in a place of Torah. And the man was as if mocking him. You want to live in Brooklyn? Brooklyn's more the houses on top of each other. There's no driveway. There's no parking. You want to live in Williamsburg? You want to live in the small ghetto? Why don't you come to the country with us? We have big homes. We have nice lifestyle. You live off the fat of the land. You'll enjoy yourself. He was trying to mimic, what do you get out of the ghetto? And the rabbi said, no. Any bad ever been a kum Torah. This is a Torah community. We have to be fortunate that we live in Brooklyn. You can't imagine it. Compared to where other people live, even in the tri-state area, there's no city of Torah like Brooklyn. Rabbi Miller said it many times. Brooklyn is a Makom Torah. No Jewish community in America has what we have over here. Synagogues on every block, Jewish people walking everywhere, Torah institutions, all concentrated in one. So we know we go away for the summer to also religious communities. You can't compare it. Houses are so far from each other. The institutions are so far. You cannot create that atmosphere of pressure, of Torah. It's not created. One guy walking over there, one guy walking over there. You can hear echoes. And here you come. Everybody's together. It's close. It's on top of you. You see it. So big zechut. Any dar ela be makom Torah. We have to appreciate it. We live in a teva. Unfortunately, there's some holes in the teva. There's some pollution. And therefore, we have to be like to the end, to stick its nose in once in a while to the yeshiva. This Torah center is a modern-day teva. I'll finish with one more story, and I'll let you go. There was a farmer. The farmer, who was a naive type of guy, and there was a thief that broke into his stable one night, and he stole one of his horses. The thief came back that night to the second stable to steal the second horse. The farmer hears some rustling going on. The farmer runs out. Now the ganav says, "Achilak, I'm going to get caught. What am I going to do?" He runs into the first stable that's empty now, and he gets down on all fours, and he's just standing there. He's looking. Farmer walks in, sees the high gate, eh? He says, "What are you doing? Excuse me, well, who are you? What are you doing here?" He says, "I'm your faithful horse." He says, "What? What do you mean you're my faithful horse? You're a human being." He says, I'll be honest with you, I have to tell you the story. He says, "My name is Yankel, and originally I was a man, but what happened is I made a lot of avonot, I made a lot of sins, and God punished me and brought me down as your horse. But tonight in the Beit Din, the heavenly court, they decided that my tikkun is over, I fulfilled my mission, so they turned me back into a human being." The farmer says, "Why can't you believe it? You should have rushed him on the heart. I saw open miracle in front of my eyes. I saw Gilgun Neshamot. I saw my horse turn into a human being. He runs to tell his wife, come look, that's a horse, that's only the guy now, Yankel, his name is..." "I can't believe it. My friend's not going to know what I'm saying." He said, "Okay, get up. You know, you're a human being. Stand up. Here's $100. Go out. Go live. You're giving the guy now $100. He gives him the money. He says, go enjoy. Go to the city. Do whatever. You know, live. That's it. Yeah, you know." He said, thank you. "Okay, nice working for you with it." He leaves. Now, the next day, the farmer has to go buy a new horse. He goes to the marketplace. He sees a horse. He's looking. He looks at the sign. Even has his initials engraved on the bottom. He says, "This is my horse." And he turns to the horse and he says, "Yanko, one day on the street and you're ready, you're back to being a horse." And you see from over here this story, one day on the street already is able to affect us drastically. Even one day being outside. So if we don't come back to the Torah, to the Teva often, and breathe the fresh air of Torah, and insulate ourselves, we have no shot. Odds are, if the majority of the people telling you the 10-inch line is bigger, you're going to agree with them. The majority of the world is corrupt. You don't do passiveness, you'll come to agree with them. I'm not saying fully, but you'll be closer to them than you are to our side. Lesson simple. Keep on coming to the Wednesday night class. Keep on coming to the Torah class in the morning. Keep on studying. Insulate your children from when they're young to live in the yeshiva. When they come out, see to it that they're still connected somehow and somewhat to the modern teva of Noach, the yeshivot, and the Kohanim. Baruch HaMarayim Olam.